convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And I can hardly put into words how excited I am and honored to be speaking for the next few minutes on the morning show with Jazz Jennings. I know many of you probably are acquainted with the story of Jazz Jennings and how her experience as a transgender young woman has been so helpful to so many others who have experienced the same thing, although perhaps not in quite the same way. And Jazz Jennings, whose story is well known to many, particularly through the documentary series about her life on TLC called I Am Jazz, has just written a book called Being Jazz, My Life as a Transgender Teen, published by Crown Books. And we have Jazz Jennings on the phone for the next few minutes to talk about her life and experience. Jazz Jennings, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hello, I'm so glad to be speaking with you.
And this is the second time in the last year and a half that I've been able to speak with a transgender person. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. The first person that I talked to is someone who was already a family friend and somebody who actually came to understand this and begin the transition as a college student. Your experience, of course, is dramatically different. You tell us in your book that from your first coherent thoughts, you knew that you were a girl, that you were absolutely certain of this. Were there never any even brief moments where you kind of wondered or doubted that? Or have you been absolutely certain, essentially, as long as you've been alive?
I've always been absolutely certain. As soon as I could express myself, I just knew I was a girl. I was gravitating towards dolls, dresses, high heels, everything feminine. And it wasn't that I just liked these girly things, but I insisted to my parents, my family, that I was a girl. And I knew how I felt on the inside, and no one else was going to change that. I was so stubborn and defiant that I would have refused to leave the house in boy clothes or be presented as a male to the public. So my parents, they just thought it was a phase at first, but phases end, and this was definitely not ending. So they realized I was different, and through unconditional love and support and just embracement, they were able to accept me for who I was, and eventually I was able to transition.
I really appreciate in the book how you describe their experience, that is, the experience of your parents and your siblings, for that matter, as well. At one point, you say they were on a road with no map, and they always loved you but didn't want you to be hurt. Talk for a moment about the difference between your mother and your father in terms of the sort of the speed with which they came to terms with this and came to accept this. There were some interesting differences between the two of them.
Basically the first person to come around. Both of my parents knew that they loved me no matter what, and all they wished for was my happiness. But my dad, he wasn't so sure about it. He really didn't know as much about being transgender as my mom did, and he just wasn't fully there yet. And it was much harder for him, but soon he eventually came around as well, and they supported me. They didn't encourage me, but they embraced me for who I was, and they listened to my lead. They allowed me to make my own decisions, and that's super important for all parents to do. And together we kind of embarked upon this journey, and we all transitioned as a family.
Right. I like how you say at one point that for your father, who was a little slower to accept all of this, you say he was looking at my situation through a protective lens, and his hesitancy had very little to do with accepting this reality and more about just trying to decide what was going to be the best thing for you and for your well-being and happiness. They also made a wise decision, I think, which is that before this reality got shared with the wider world, in your words, they wanted to make sure that your own family was acclimated before, for instance, anybody at your school was told about this. Talk for a moment about that process of of bringing your siblings on board and what their reaction was and continues to be?
Young that they don't even remember me living my life as a boy. They always just kind of thought of me as a girl. So for them, it was easy. They're like, oh, yeah, Jazz is our sister. We know that. But my sister, she was a little bit older, and she had a hard time, you know, realizing that she wasn't going to be the only princess of the house anymore. And it was really hard for her. She was about 8 years old, but my parents decided to explain to her that transgender kids like myself can often become depressed, and very much so suicidal if they can't live their life as who they are. And she said to my parents, I understand now. I will love my sister no matter what. And that's just a beautiful thing that she was able to come around and realize that she wanted to protect her sister. So my siblings, they're absolutely amazing. My whole family is incredible, and I love them so much.
And it seems they are interviewed by the editor of the book at the end of the book, and They express such love for you, and they also seem to have little, if any, resentment whatsoever about all of the attention that's been given to you. And it seems like that says something about them and also something about the way your parents and you have tried to handle the spotlight that has been shining on you for all these years. They don't seem to resent that at all, as far as we can tell.
My whole family understands that we are doing this for a better cause. This is not about us at all. It's about the message that we're sharing and how it can impact other people. When we hear stories from transgender kids saying that, you know, they aren't sure if they would be alive if it wasn't for our family sharing our story, it just shows that we are doing the right thing, and we understand we're part of a bigger movement where we're trying to make a difference and achieve equality for all. And it's great that, you know, my whole family could really support me on that.
One of the stories here is of the various struggles, for instance, to get your school to understand this, for their policies to be accepting of this, and the long fight that especially your dad waged when it came to getting you a place on a girls' soccer team. You love the sport of soccer so much. So the book is partly about some of those big struggles. But at one point, you also talk about how the small fights, the little fights about little incidents of name-calling and so on, you've figured out along the way that those small fights should not be shrugged off, that in a sense it all matters, both the big struggles and the small little everyday struggles as well. Can you say a word about that?
Yeah, I definitely think they're all equally important. They show that discrimination continues to take place and society still isn't fully there yet, whether it's an entire, you know, soccer association or if it's just one, you know, girl calling me names. They're both equally important because they are both being, you know, they both don't understand. They're being ignorant and they just are kind of jumping to conclusions about who I am as a person without understanding me. And it's important for me to continue sharing my story and educating other people until those individuals really wrap their minds around the concept, open up their hearts and minds, and realize that I'm a person as well, and all transgender people deserve to be treated equally.
Explain to our listeners the moment that your parents decided to have what I think you call a coming out party.
So when I turned 5 years old, I guess you could call it a coming out party. Basically, my parents said for my birthday, I could wear any bathing suit I wanted. And I picked out this sparkly rainbow bathing suit. And I was just so excited to be presented as a female to all of my friends and to their families. It was one of the best days of my life. Well, for the first 5 years of my life. And it was just an incredible moment and a huge turning point, you know, forever.
Mm. One of the things that you talk about in this book was a great turning point for your mother was a dance recital. This is earlier than this coming out party, where she saw something that really helped her understand just how serious this was. Explain that moment to our listeners.
So basically, when I was 4 years old, I was going to be in this dance recital, and I was so excited. I loved to dance. I loved to be with all the girls, and I was just super happy about it. So the day of the dance recital came, and I realized that all of the girls were wearing tutus, and I was not. And that made me super devastated. I remember the song started playing, all the girls were dancing, and I just sat there snapping my finger, biting my lip, and with these deep eyes of pain, I stared at my mother, and she just saw in that moment, it confirmed her, you know, beliefs that I was different and that something needed to change in order for me to be happy.
Hmm. You, of course, began sharing your story with the world. One of the first significant ways that was done was when you were interviewed by the legendary Barbara Walters. As you describe what that experience was like, one of my favorite things about the story is the song that you were singing that day. It happens to be one of my favorite songs, but I've never thought about the words until you talk about that song from Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella.
Yeah, the song is always about, you know, being who you want to be and just opening up your mind to the possibilities of who you are. And I think the words are so beautiful. And at that time, I don't even know if six-year-old Jazz understood it, but I love that song as well. And now looking back at it, it was really a great moment, and I'm glad I shared that with her and the world.
Right. In my own little corner, in my own little chair, I can be whatever I want to be. You explain a lot about what your journey has been like, including, you know, you explain some of the physical realities of being on blockers and so on, just kind of shape your body and so on. You also talk a bit about the way in which people can more sensitively interact with you. We could talk about so many things, but I think we have time for just one. I think it's really interesting. You say that often people will say to you when they see you, and you know you're such a beautiful young lady, and they would never guess from looking at you that you had been physically born a boy. But you say that when people say, I never would have known that, you know, you used to be a boy, is actually a very rude thing to say. Explain why we really need to be careful not to say things like that to a transgender person.
Saying something like, I never would have known that you were transgender because you're so beautiful, really makes our community feel like we are not beautiful. It's putting this stereotype that all transgender people don't look physically attractive, and that's not okay to say something like that about someone. It kind of is really just kind of, it's being prejudiced about our whole community, and it's offensive.
Hmm. You tell us that your life, for as out of the ordinary as it is in terms of all the attention you've enjoyed, is also in many ways a very ordinary life. Just say a word about that balance between the kind of the ordinary and the extraordinary that is the way your life unfolds, especially nowadays.
Yeah, I'm just a teenage girl trying to live my life. You know, I play soccer. I love to be creative. I have school. I have friends. And I'm doing all those things. But at the same time, I'm also sharing my story and trying to impact people on a larger scale so that they can understand that living your life authentically, being your genuine self, and just loving yourself no matter what is a beautiful thing. And you just have to share that love with other people, and then our society could unite and we could just live in a beautiful world.
Hmm. You also are very honest in the book about the fact that you have contended a bit with depression. And I think that's probably going to be pretty shocking for anybody who has seen you, heard you talk, seen you in your television and program. You're such a joyous, vibrant person. But it really underscores the fact that depression isn't really about, you know, if you're a cheerful person or not. It's about something else. And it's a reality that has been difficult for you at times. How are you doing in that respect?
Yeah, so my depression has nothing to do with me being transgender. It's just genetic. My mom has it, and it's been really hard for me to deal with it. You know, I get in this dark state where I have no hope, and I just feel like there's no worth in moving forward. And it's really emotional. But by, you know, resolving the conflict inside, you know, following my inner heart, I try to get out of it. I try to think of positive thoughts, and then I kind of just click, and then I'm able to slowly transition out of it. And It can be very, very difficult, but it's something that I really wanted to share because my story, although it has been such a, you know, positive, happy message of a transgender child who is really living a great life, I also face struggles as well. And I think sharing my depression makes me more of a human, a person who really goes through difficult times as well. So I think people will relate to that and understand that, you know, I'm not perfect.
Well, you're a very special young lady, and your story is such an important one to be shared with the world. And you do that beautifully in this book, Being Jazz, My Life as a Transgender Teen, published by Crown. Jazz Jennings, thank you so much, and very best wishes to you and your whole family with all that stretches ahead.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
For part two of today's morning show, we're going to be replaying a portion of our conversation with Hillary Whittington, the author of a book called Raising Ryland, Our Story of Parenting a Transgender Child with No Strings Attached. The Whittingtons discovered that their child, who was born physically as a little girl, in fact, emotionally and mentally, was a little boy. So they had to come to grips with the transgender nature of their child, and also had to come to grips before that with the fact that their child suffered from profound hearing loss.
It was around Ryland's first birthday, and let me just preface that by saying that members of the family had made comments to me leading up to that day about Ryland's hearing. And being that Ryland was our first child, we didn't really have anything to compare Ryland to. We knew that it was typical for a child to begin to start talking around a year old, but Ryland was so visual that Ryland fooled us for a long, long time. We would walk into a room and call Ryland's name, and Ryland would turn to us, but it was because Ryland could see us. So visually, Ryland was very keen, and we really lived in denial for a couple of months leading up to Ryland's deaf diagnosis, because Ryland really had a great way of hiding, masking the fact that he wasn't hearing. But in that moment when my father-in-law called me, I had a lot of guilt that began to fall onto my shoulders, because I had actually seen many of the signs. And really, I think Jeff and I both had put it out of our minds. Nobody wants to believe that there's anything wrong with their child. And, you know, of course, now even looking back on video, we were constantly tapping Ryland to get his attention. And I was, without even realizing it, buying Ryland light-up toys, because that was the only positive reaction I could get from Ryland. In that moment, it was just a gush of emotion, thinking to myself, why have I been in denial for so long? And I wish that I would have paid closer attention. After that phone call, it was like almost instantaneous that I began doing my own tests. And it was very clear to us that day and that evening that Ryland could not hear. So I began the grieving process that day.
Grieving for the future that you had imagined for her, a future that was perhaps not going to play out anything close to what you had imagined or envisioned. I think one of the most poignant moments you describe at this point in the book, where you have just begun to really face this possibility, which very clearly was actually, in fact, a reality, that there was something wrong with Ryland's hearing. It's when you are with her at some kind of a class, and I believe this might be actually, by sort of strange coincidence, I think it was a baby sign language class, and you were already signed up for it without any conscious thought of the fact that your daughter might need to use sign language as somebody with profound hearing loss. Explain, first of all, just briefly, what prompted you to have her take part in this class, and then this really sad moment on, I think, the very first day as you see her with these other children.
Yeah, my very best friend at the time, who had a baby the same age as Ryland, had been talking about this class in our area for a few weeks, and I owe it all to her, because she had taken some sign language classes in college and sort of told me the benefits of even hearing children taking baby sign language classes. So it was really my friend Jen who prompted me to to take that step into that class, and it was really ironic, just the timing of all of it, because I had had another friend say to me, you know, earlier in Rylan's life that I should do it, and I kind of laughed it off and thought it was a little absurd, just not understanding how beneficial it really is. So, yeah, the timing of that was really interesting, but pretty phenomenal at the same time, because as soon as we introduced sign language to Rylan, you know, his vocabulary in sign language took off. So he had about 250 signs memorized by the time he actually had surgery. So in less than a year, he just soaked all of it up.
Mm.
It was pretty amazing.
But this moment is so poignant where it's this first mm-hmm. class and the teacher's kind of beginning with some music for everybody to enjoy together. And you mm-hmm. write, the other babies in the room smile up at their mothers, shrill their voices and thrill bounce to the music, flag their arms with the sound, all of them except for Ryland. Our little girl does nothing to respond to the music. It's as if she's in her own little world. The truth is beginning to crystallize. Ryland cannot hear. In this communal setting, the even heavier thought occurs to me. My daughter is left out of experiencing life as the other babies are. I mean, I think that really gets at the heart of something that for the rest of us on the outside looking in might miss. That is one mm-hmm. facet of what makes a situation like this so sad.
Yeah, it was devastating. It really was. And you know, I feel guilty saying it now because I know the deaf community is very proud of who they are. And, you know, but I have to admit, as a hearing parent coming from a hearing family, to think of your child spending the rest of their life not being able to communicate with the world is a pretty devastating reality. And at the time, I didn't know about cochlear implants. And, you know, of course, I sat and pictured Rylan going to a special school and sitting at the family dinner table, not knowing what was going on sometimes. And, you know, just family events where we had extended family that didn't know sign language. And that's a really sad thought, to think of your child being left out of the world and possibly being bullied or, you know, anything like that. So yeah, it was definitely a very difficult reality for me.
You, of course, do learn about the implants that can, in fact, make a dramatic difference for her, and they did. And I also want you to share yet another poignant moment. It is on the 1st of July as you are bringing Ryland in for the surgery for these implants to be made. You pass an entryway, and your husband, Jeff, notices the sign on that doorway, and it, in a sense, really puts what you were experiencing in perspective. You remember the moment I'm talking about?
I sure do. Yep, it was, you know, really what we were dealing with wasn't a matter of life and death. And there were parents right on the other side of that door who were worried that their children wouldn't be alive the next day. You know, yeah, you have to think about that. We had a healthy child in all other aspects. Maybe would struggle in one way. But at the end of the day, we could always put our arms around our child and hug him and give him the best possible life we could and not fear that he would be, you know, we would lose him from his diagnosis.
Yeah, the doorway said pediatric oncology unit. And you write, I take his hand, I think of the families who have occupied the rooms inside this hallway, how all of them would probably trade places with us in a heartbeat. We're speaking with Hillary Whittington and talking about her book, Raising Ryland, Our Story of Parenting a Transgender Child with No Strings Attached. Early in the book, you refer, of course, to Ryland as she, as her, as your daughter. But, of course, we are about to probe into the other facet of this story, which is so intriguing. First, we should say just a quick word about the exciting day known as Activation Day, which was the day that these cochlear implants were, I guess, activated, and for the first time, Ryland was actually able to hear. As you recount, you have this video, and you're hoping that the video you're going to take is going to be one of those heartwarming videos that we see on YouTube of that beautiful moment when a child squeals in delight or laughs or cheers. It wasn't exactly that for you and Ryland.
No, you know, we did post the video at the at that time, but looking back on it now, you know, we didn't know what to expect. There's some children that smile, that love the sound. Ryland, for whatever reason, I believe now that Ryland's ears were turned up far too loud for his first activation appointment. But looking back on it, Ryland's body got very tense. And Ryland looked in my eyes, and I'll never forget the look. But it was a look of fear, and it really worried me. I wondered if I just hoped that Ryland would get used to the new sense that he was experiencing. And as a parent, it's just very difficult because I really didn't know what to do to help him like the sound. And so for the first, you know, a few months, I had to really bribe Ryland with candy to wear his cochlear implants. And now looking back, I understand that I don't believe that they were activated the way that they should have been. And I think it was too loud for him. So, yeah, it was definitely an exciting moment, but an intense moment as well.
Right. And it's interesting, too, how you describe your tenacious efforts in the weeks and months to follow to help build Ryland's skills with language. At one point you say, I have to make up for 2 years of lost hearing time. And in a sense, in doing so, trying to assuage the guilt you probably still felt at somehow missing this or not facing up to it sooner. But then, of course, a new reality asserts itself, which neither you nor your husband could possibly have been ready for. Although there had been mild little signs that Ryland was very much a tomboy. And then one day you walk in to the house and Ryland is nowhere to be found. You eventually track down Ryland in a closet. Tell us what you saw.
Yeah, Ryland would begin sneaking off, and he would go hide in Jeff's closet and pull down Jeff's, you know, really nice clothes, his shirts and his ties, which at the time he never, ever wore because he was a firefighter. And he would get dressed up in his dad's clothes, and at the time he was a little girl. So for me, again, Ryland was my first child, so I didn't really know what to expect. But I wasn't angry that he wanted to dress up in his dad's clothes. It just got to a point where he would want to track around the house in clothes that were 10 sizes too large for him. And he began to ruin Jeff's nice pants and nice shirts. So it wasn't a big issue to me in the beginning. What concerned me the most is that he said to me, please don't tell anybody. And that, to me, was sort of a red flag.
Right.
Why should Ryland be ashamed that he is dressing up like a boy? Right. So that was the concerning moment for me.
Right. By the way, I just have to remark, because we're trying to be, you know, careful and accurate here and so on. And you, of course, Ryland is your son. And
yep.
To you, he is he. But, of course, at this point in the book, and in a sense, at this point in the story, Ryland is a she. So when we're talking about, you know, I wasn't alarmed that he was dressing up in his father's clothes. In fact, in a sense, it was she dressing up in her father's clothes.
It's so just hard to go back for me. It's
of course.
So awkward. And I feel like I'm almost harming Ryland by referring to him as she. And truthfully, if I could have written the whole book in a he pronoun, I would have, but it would be very confusing.
Interesting, right. And I only mention it because I just want to make sure people are following this story and understanding that this was cause for alarm, and particularly the fact that that Ryland at that point in time felt such shame about this. Tell us about the battles that went on, and that escalated in intensity over time when it came to what Ryland was willing to wear, particularly outside of the house.
Oh, my goodness. That was a nightmare. And I know that sounds crazy, but when you're dealing with a child fighting you on their clothing every single moment of every single day, it gets to be very, very exhausting. And you finally just get to a point where you give up. And so with Ryland, I started off by buying gender-neutral colors. I would go to the girls' department and I would buy, you know, just plain colors in cuts that weren't very feminine, if I could. And Ryland would wear it, and eventually Ryland got a box of hand-me-down boy clothes from a friend of mine. And once Ryland got his hands on some actual boy clothing, it was really difficult to get that clothing off of Ryland. And I would have to coach Ryland for weeks leading up to an event. Hey, Ryland, we're going to wear this. And I would have to, you know, really just coach him and bribe him. And I know that's not great parenting practice, but it was very, very, very difficult, but possible, to get Ryland into girls' clothing. And part of that came from the fact that, you know, Jeff was gone quite a bit at the fire department. So essentially I felt like a single parent fighting this uphill battle. And, you know, it got to a point when I was pregnant with Brinley, our second child, that I started to feel pre-pregnancy contractions while I was fighting Ryland into an outfit. And I hit a moment of just absolute, I hit my wall. Because I thought to myself, here I am, possibly going into preterm labor because I'm trying to fight my child into clothing to make other family members happy. Mm. And I just realized that this was not healthy for me or for Ryland. And it felt to me like child abuse at one point. When you see your child, you know, just hysterically crying, foaming at the mouth practically, because he's so upset that I'm trying to put him in a dress.
Right.
And I just realized, for who am I doing this?
Right.
You know?
You also come to understand something which had been also a very significant cause for concern, namely Ryland's bedwetting and mm-hmm. and having accidents. And you came eventually to understand that there was probably a purpose for those mm-hmm. so-called accidents, in a sense. And it's probably mm-hmm. so good that you came to this understanding. What did you come to realize or believe about all the accidents that Ryland was having?
You know, there's so many different ways to look at that. But for me, at least in the daytime, when I saw Ryland wetting his pants a lot, it could have been many things. But one of the things it could have been is the fact that he didn't want to wear something. And he knew that if he had an accident in an outfit he didn't want to wear, he wouldn't have to wear it. So it could have been that. It could have been just the grief of him internally knowing that he was a boy and us not realizing it. And as a small child, how much control do you really have? You know, so I'm sure children find any way that they possibly can to control their situation. And I think for Ryland, that was one of them. Again, I think he is also, he's deaf and he works really, really hard during the day to hear and listen and know what's going on. It's so much that I don't even realize it sometimes. And I think that's another part of it. When he sleeps at night, he is just so exhausted that was another maybe part of it. But anyhow, there's no way for me to know exactly why he was doing it. But I can tell you that during the day when he was doing it, it had something to do with him not wanting to wear certain clothing.
Right. Another way in which this played out, and I think this is also something that a lot of us would never think about until reading it in your book, is the matter of when Ryland would be given gifts at, for instance, mm-hmm. birthday parties, or for no particularly special occasion, but the thing that grandparents do on a regular basis when they come back from a trip and they have a present for Ryland. Ryland was only interested, only excited in masculine-themed toys or clothing or whatever, and mm-hmm. you had to work so hard to make sure that Ryland would be polite and not express shock or dismay or disgust if mm-hmm. if given, in a sense, a standard girl gift. I have a feeling that was something you never saw coming, in a sense.
Oh, it was so stressful and so, as a parent, so hard, because I think we all want our children to be polite and respond with thank yous and, you know, to have gratification, just to be grateful for gifts. And I cringed every single time someone got Ryland a gift, because I knew that there would be disappointment, and I knew that you can't really hide that. You know, I mean, you could just see it on his face when he opened something that was intended for a little girl. It was almost like, how could you do this, and why are you giving me this? So, I mean, thank goodness over time our family caught on to it, and they quickly got on board and would get Ryland, you know, superhero gifts and things like that. But there's just really no way to control a child's reaction to a present in front of people. So that was a really stressful, horrible time for me, because I wanted to make it better, and the only way I could make it better was by telling people ahead of time what Ryland liked. Mm. So it was hard.
Right. For sure. Of course, at some point, you and your husband, Jeff, begin to confront this reality that this is not a fad, that it's not easing off. If anything, it is growing more intense by the day. And you have to come to terms with this somehow and decide what you are going to do about it. And as you say in the book, and I think it's one of the trickiest points to make, I think you do it well, never for a moment did your husband Jeff stop loving Ryland. But it was a little harder for him, evidently, to come to grips with this reality. Tell us more about his reaction, that hesitancy, that reluctance. I mean, just how significant was that? I mean, what was the nature of his struggles to understand and accept this reality about Ryland?
Well, for Jeff, he'll admit to you that for him, he avoided it altogether because out of fear. He was afraid that Ryland would have one more thing to make him a subject of bullying, or, you know, just to set him apart from the crowd. And I think as a parent, he was afraid of this reality. So he did anything in his power to avoid talking to me about it. You know, we were on completely opposite pages for a long time. And again, a lot of it came from the fact that I was with Ryland all of the time, and Jeff was working really hard to provide, so he wasn't around a ton. And also, Ryland picked up on the fact that Ryland could tell me certain things, and they were received differently than when he would tell Jeff certain things. So yeah, I mean, Jeff will admit to you that it took him much longer to get on board and to understand this. But for him, the moment of understanding really came when we went to a support group here in town, and he started to hear the stories of the other families going through this. And once he started to hear some of those devastating, heartbreaking, horrible stories from other families, his eyes opened much wider, and he realized that we couldn't ignore this any longer.
Right. And I guess what you're saying there is it was your belief, already your belief, and it became Jeff's belief as well, that by allowing Ryland to transition now rather than waiting for, you know, years from now, you would be helping Ryland to avoid years of a very special and sort of cruel kind of heartbreak. If you could allow Ryland to be who he was at this point in time, even though Ryland was only five, this was the best way to ensure his happiness and well-being.
Absolutely. Yep.
I wonder if you could also tie in something very significant, which was the story of your brother. You mentioned very briefly earlier in the interview that your brother died not long before Ryland was born. And I don't think we've yet mentioned that your brother had struggled for years and years with very serious substance abuse. So his life was difficult. Things were turning around, and then his unexpected death was a terrible blow for you. You mention your brother and his death and his difficult life at the point in the book when you are talking with Jeff about Ryland. What is the heart of that connection?
The heart of the connection is just that I watched my brother struggle most of his life, trying to fit in and not being a very confident person for whatever reason. And, you know, after seeing him struggle his whole life, and then, of course, losing him tragically at such a young age, it just prepares me and equips me with a lot more than most parents. I think I know deep down that I never want to see my child struggling like my brother did. And, you know, although it may be for different reasons, I also know that I don't want Ryland to fall into that 41% attempted suicide rate, because I've already lost someone so close to me, and I can't even fathom losing anyone else close to me. So for me, I felt that losing my brother and just what I had gone through with him sort of gave me the foundation to do what I needed to do for Ryland so that he doesn't fall into that path, really.
When you decide that you will allow Ryland to transition, that is, to live life as a boy, which is Ryland's fervent wish, one of the points of contention is about Ryland's hair. Talk a moment about a moment when Ryland said something to you about this matter of hair, and why you think ultimately this was a very important, in a sense, moment of passage for him in his transition.
Are you referring to the time when he said, "When the family dies, I will
cut
my hair"?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm sorry. Can you just repeat exactly?
I want you to tell our listeners about, kind of describe that moment, and ultimately then that first time that Ryland's hair is cut to that of a boy, in a sense, and what you think that represented in terms of a significant point in his transition.
Absolutely. So I think for Ryland, he was already dressing much like a boy at this time. You know, for the most part, he was wearing mostly boy's clothing, and he had this long hair that I would still try and put bows in. It was a terrible fight as well. But I think for Ryland, cutting his hair was the sort of final piece that he needed to look at himself in the mirror and look at the person that he felt he was inside. At the same time, we knew that that was a huge step as a family, because then Ryland would be really presenting in the world as a boy. So we knew that once Ryland cut his hair, we needed to explain things to people and really take that next step to change pronouns. And Jeff didn't want to take Ryland. At the time, we still had Ryland as our daughter. He didn't want to take Ryland down to his very Catholic barber shop that he would go down to, because that's kind of an awkward thing. You take your daughter into your barber shop and ask for them to completely cut their hair off. I don't know how that would have been received, but Jeff was afraid. And so I finally said, you know what, I'm going to do it. So I took Ryland and began to start cutting Ryland's hair. The biggest mistake that we made before we did that was that we warned Ryland of what others might think. And we didn't know it at the time, but that was a really big no-no, because we almost instilled inside of Ryland shame and almost made him feel like what we were doing was wrong and that he should be afraid of people's reactions. So looking back on it, I think I would have done that differently. But that's sort of how it all went down. I mean, at the time, we didn't know how to take that next step, and we didn't know what to do. And so we just sort of took it into our own hands. And once Ryland had a terrible haircut by me, then Jeff was able to take him down and have it fixed.
There you go. And I wonder is this the closest you ever came to telling Ryland in so many words, we're going to allow you to live as a boy now? I mean, You never really describe exactly a moment where those exact words get said, but do you think that's what this represented to Ryland?
I think so. I mean, to be honest with you, Ryland's confidence just sort of began to grow instantly the second we started referring to Ryland as he and our son. It was almost like you could see his shoulders perk up and, you know, his chest puff out a little bit every single time we began calling him our son. And so, yeah, it was a sort of a progression over time. And to be honest with you, his hyper-masculinity from before has completely dissipated, meaning that, you know, before he transitioned, he would only drink out of a blue cup. He would only eat off of a blue plate. He would never, ever be got dead playing with a girl toy or something pink. And it's crazy because now that we've affirmed him and he knows that we see him as our son, he's really relaxed. And now he will eat off a pink plate if that's the only one that's clean. So it's really just been remarkable to watch the whole transition take place.
I want us to take a moment to just talk about the matter of as he went to school and the fact that you actually seem to have been very fortunate to send him to a school that was really quite sensitive to the situation. And it sounds like also he's been blessed to have really, really great supportive friends. But you mentioned in the chapter called Educating the Educators that one of the most tricky balancing acts was that you wanted everyone who worked at that school to understand Ryland's story. And yet, in your words, we didn't want the word to get out that Ryland is the odd kid out at school whose presence demands this training or who needs special treatment. It's a balance that we need to strike between preparing the adults and kids around Ryland and preventing stigma. I bet that really is a tricky matter, to prepare everybody around Ryland for Ryland's uncommon situation and yet wanting him also to be treated like a normal kid.
Right. And, you know, it's really hard because we wanted everyone to understand it, but at the same time, we had to sort of, quote unquote, out ourselves in front of everyone in order to allow them to really connect to what was happening. And that was something that we struggled with. We were told that it isn't really a good thing for us to do a training at our son's school because then everybody knows that that's our son, you know, that's transgender. But really, we struggled with it, and we just realized that if we wanted everyone to really understand what this was like for us, we felt that we were the ones best to do that. So it was a very, very, it was a hard line to walk, but we did.
Well, it's an amazing story, and it's so uplifting and encouraging in that people have been remarkably responsive and sensitive and welcoming. There have been tough times, of course, as well, and you share about that as well. But overall, it is an incredibly positive story. What can you tell us about how Ryland is doing today?
Ryland is doing amazing. He is your typical 8-year-old little boy. But he's great in school. He's a very, very good reader, and he's top of his class in his math and knows more about computers than I do, has more friends than I can even tell you. We're just trying to live a normal life, and I think that's been the really hard balance of all of this, is that we really want people to understand, but at the same time, we want his life to be typical. We don't want him to feel like there's this huge spotlight on him. So it's been a very delicate balance. I really believe that by us coming out and sharing our story now, hopefully I'm taking the burden off of him so that later he doesn't feel like he has to explain himself to everyone. But at the same time, you know, we're dealing with a child, and so we're very, very careful with what we allow Ryland to hear and see, because parts of me doesn't, you know, I don't really want him to know that people are being murdered because of this, and children are killing themselves because of this. I mean, those are some pretty heavy things. I don't necessarily want him to know right now. So yeah, for the most part, he's a really typical kid, and we live a really quite normal, boring life.
Well, there's nothing boring about the book. It's a remarkable book. You tell this story so beautifully. Again, the book is called Raising Ryland, Our Story of Parenting a Transgender Child with No Strings Attached. It is a paperback from William Morrow and the author Hillary Whittington. Hillary Whittington, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for writing this terrific book. Best wishes.
Thank you so much, Greg. I appreciate it. Take care.